supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Let's return to those thrilling days of yesteryear when mankind first walked on the moon. Joining me with a look back and then ahead is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, this time around, there's a new way to take in what took place in the summer of 69.
It's a really exciting way for people who did not experience the first manned landing on the moon to get a feel for all of the excitement that surrounded this truly historic human exploration event. There is a website, firstmenonthemoon.com, that allows a viewer to actually listen to a replay of the actual audio communications between ground control and the astronauts from about 15 minutes before Apollo 11 landed on the surface of the moon. There's a center screen that shows you whatever video might have been taking place or available at that time. And then flanking that center screen on the left, you see the text of the communication of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on board Apollo 11 as it's heading down toward the surface to land. On the right side of that center screen, you see the text of all of the communications that's happening back at ground control. And all of this is taking place in this tightly packed period of about 15 minutes.
Spoiler alert, they land successfully, but I imagine it's just as thrilling to watch this replay as it was, lo, those 49 years ago.
I think it's even more exciting in that there's so much going on behind the scenes that we weren't aware of at the time. And if any of those things go wrong, what they'll do is they'll communicate that back up to the Apollo astronauts and tell them to abort the mission. They're not involved in that at all. They're focused on landing the spacecraft safely. And as we all know, in the last minute or so, Neil Armstrong had to take command of the over the automatic landing system in order to avoid a boulder field where the spacecraft was originally targeted to land. But as you see this unfolding, it's all happening in real time in the last like 2 or 3 minutes before the spacecraft is supposed to land, while all this other monitoring of systems and health and all that stuff is going on.
Is it an overstatement to say that the technology was positively primitive compared to what we have now?
Think of any measure you'd like to think of. Your smartphone is 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times more capable in terms of computer capability than what they had at the time. The communications we have these days is so much better. Propulsion systems are so much better. In fact, if you went back and you looked at the cockpit of the lunar module, you would wonder how they ever flew such an antiquated piece of equipment all the way to the moon and back. Well, I think the big secret is that you had two irreplaceable pieces of equipment, and those were the humans on board who could manipulate all this stuff given their level of skill, talent, and capability.
Let's also give props to the third man overhead for the duration.
Yes, Michael Collins, who was in the command module orbiting the moon, was monitoring everything from there as well. He was in control of the ship that would bring everybody back to Earth after the mission was done. It put him farther away from the Earth than any other human at any point in human history. So he had a very unique perspective, and it was one that he actually relished. He's actually said he enjoyed his time alone in the spacecraft.
Hanging out on the dark side.
On the dark side, looking back at a spectacular planet Earth.
Let's head out to the further reaches of our solar system. I understand new studies are adding to the list of possibilities regarding the origins of the protoplanet Pluto.
We really did not think that Pluto was going to turn out to be the spectacular solar system object that it is. Now comes the possibility that Pluto could potentially be composed of perhaps several billion comets. It looks like its composition is much more similar to that of what cometary composition would be like than planetary composition. So there's the thought, a new study that's based in data collected from the New Horizons spacecraft, that perhaps Pluto could be the result of the coalescence of a billion or more comets.
Do comets behave that way?
Well, no. Of course there's a catch, and we come right down to it. We haven't seen anything like that, an agglomeration of comets that could be built up into something the size of, shall we say, dare say in the case of Pluto, the size of a planet. although we are certainly aware of the vast number of comets that have been part of our solar system throughout its history, the idea that they could somehow come together in this way and then fall into an orbit around the sun really says that there's a lot more work that has to be done.
What are some of the prevailing theories of how Pluto got there and why?
One of the earlier possibilities of Pluto's origin was suggested that it perhaps was a passing body that was captured by the gravitational pull of the four outer planets of our solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. There's some thought that it could possibly be an escaped moon of Neptune. Its composition is telling us more so than not that it was not an original member of the solar system, but something that somehow became part of our family quite some time later.
With clear skies, which of the original planets are available to be seen this week?
It really is a spectacular panoply of planets. It's as if there's a samba line of planets moving across the sky from west all the way back over to east. So just as the sky is getting dark at 9:15 in the evening, over on the western side, brilliant Venus. If we come back to the left around to the south, we find gleaming Jupiter. A little bit further to the east, a little dimmer but still out there and not twinkling like the other planets, is Saturn. And then by 11 p.m. over on the eastern side of the sky, now up high enough in the east, is Mars. Mars is getting brighter and brighter as it comes to opposition later this month, so that's there to be seen. If you're having difficulty tracing these planets down, an easy way to do it is simply look for where the moon will be found. So the moon will be right above Jupiter on July 20th. It'll be right above Saturn on July 24th and right above Mars on July 27th. So that makes it really easy. Now, to help out with this, the Delaware Valley Amateur Astronomers are hosting a public star party coming up on July 21st at Valley Forge National Historic Park. Plenty of telescopes of all varieties so that you can get a good view of this great planetary viewing this time of year. And with really, really knowledgeable people who know their way around a telescope and know their way around the night sky.
More information at
www.dvaa.org. You can find the information there.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.